This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN1290. We're online at TSN1290.ca. A reminder, next Wednesday, the Stanley Cup Finals get underway. We know one of the teams, it's the New York Rangers. After tomorrow night, we'll know who their opponents are, either the Los Angeles Kings or the Chicago Blackhawks. In any event, the entire Stanley Cup Finals can be heard here on TSN 1290. We're your home of the Winnipeg Jets. We're also your home for the Stanley Cup Finals here in Winnipeg. Mentioned the Winnipeg Jets. It's sort of been a decently long time since we've had a lot to talk about regarding the Jets. Not a lot of news coming out of any of the NHL cities that aren't currently in the playoffs or didn't fire their head coach or their general manager or one or the other. But the Winnipeg Jets made a little bit of news yesterday when it was announced by Yuri Nikolaev. That's the Russian agent for former Winnipeg Jets player Alex Burmistrov, that Burmy is going to spend next year in Kazakhstan again with Akbars Kazan rather than return to the NHL. There was some speculation that with Claude Noel having moved on from his role as head coach of the Winnipeg Jets, that maybe Burmistrov would be interested in making a return to Winnipeg. That doesn't appear to be the case for the 2014-15 campaign, as he's going to stay in Russia for another year. But that agent as well didn't close the door that Burmistrov would.
What agent does, Drew?
A bad agent, I would say, yeah. would completely shut a door, but fair point. Anyways, for now, Alex Burmistrov still in the KHL. Did you really expect him to return to the Jets next year?
No, I didn't. I didn't think he was going to be back with the Jets. I don't really think the Jets particularly want him, Drew. I mean, it's just, sure, it's an asset, and it'll be an asset next year. I don't think they particularly wanted him back. His salary demands probably would have been too high for where they would have slotted him. They have Scheifele and Little ahead of him. Does he want to come back in a third-line role? Would he accept playing in a defensive spot? Hold on. Like, wasn't that the reason he complained last time, that he was playing in a third-line role? So, I mean, I'm not shocked by that. He can make more money over there, and I think at the end of the day, if you're talking about what the answer is probably money as to the main reason, but there are other factors as well. And you know how he is in the room. He came out last time. For whatever you think of Olli Jokinen, and you know, I certainly am one of his probably his critics more than anybody. But at the same time, you know, when you leave and say, oh, I should have played, or at least through people, I should have played over Jokinen, whether or not you believe that, you shouldn't say that in the public. And in any event, you were a young guy and a veteran ahead of you. That doesn't earn you any respect in the locker room. So I know people have tended to glorify his skill set. And while he has skills, I don't think he was particularly effective his first time around. And I don't think it's anything that's going to change the course of what the Jets are trying to do. I don't think the Jets ever planned for him to be part of next year's squad.
And Richie, nothing has changed since Alexander Burmistrov last played for the Winnipeg Jets, in the sense that if his attitude hasn't changed and his willingness to play a role that is assigned to him hasn't changed, then he doesn't have that future with the Winnipeg Jets. And we know that he's still property of the Winnipeg Jets, and that will continue. Him only being 20, I don't know if he's 22 yet, 21 or 22, he's still very young. But if that doesn't change, and we know that, and Richie documented it, and we've talked about it a lot on the station, many programs on the station, and fans of the Jets will know that Alexander Burmistrov had trouble and, you know, found himself in Claude Noel's doghouse. But he's a player that is interesting going forward, too, because of how young he is and how he came into the NHL at such a young age after being a Thrashers draft pick in 2010. And, you know, he's someone that they'll keep an eye on. I imagine the Jets are keeping an eye on him, and when the right time comes, if he has made that change, I imagine, then he'll be asked to come back. But right now, as Richie mentioned, I don't think that in the short term, Kevin Cheveldayoff and Craig Heisinger, their top priority is Alexander Burmistrov. They're obviously focusing on the draft, and they're focusing on the St. John's Ice Caps, who are doing an awesome job, and hopefully they'll be able to bring the cup to the Rock.
Up 3-1 in their Eastern Conference
up
final.
Up 3-1. But Alexander Burmistrov is not someone that I think Chevy is thinking about and losing sleep over.
Do you think the Jets would have ever drafted Burmistrov as the Jets brass is currently constructed?
0% chance.
0% chance. So, I mean, I don't think they're, you know, people like to talk about it and they need things to talk about. Oh, Burmy, how would he look here and there? And I actually think Burmy is a very solid defensive player, especially for a young player. But you have to be willing to take on that role. And you have to be willing to play a certain style and willing to improve at face-offs and willing to do different things. And we don't know if he's willing to do any of those things.
Well, the knock on a lot of Russian players is that they're only interested in the offensive side of the game and not the defensive side. Whereas, to your point that you just made, I thought Alex Burmistrov was always, you know, pretty responsible, pretty decent. He, you know, got some penalty killing time, so he obviously had some bona fides in his own zone when he played for the Jets.
I'm not saying that he wouldn't be an upgrade over the hole they have there now, and I think he'd be a better third line center than Olli Jokinen just because of that defensive ability and some other things. But at the same time, though, I don't think it was realistic to expect him to come back, and I would hope the Jets would fill that third line center void with somebody other than Olli Jokinen. But I think that was part of the plan from the outset, Drew. I mean, Jokinen may be back, and we don't know yet based on the other options, and there are limited options out there in the free agent market, which will, you know, go over leading into the draft and free agency. But at the same time, I mean, do you think the Jets were holding out hope that he would come? I don't think it was ever that way. I don't think it's one of those things where the Jets were hoping he came back and he said no. I think it was one of those things where the Jets probably would have listened to it if he wanted to come back, but otherwise we're just like, you know, whatever. Lots was made up of Maurice and coaching in the KHL. Well, I mean, let's take it easy there. He coached in the KHL for 1 year. Suddenly, you know, he understands the players more, and Burmistrov is going to come. At the end of the day, all that matters is money and ice time. Forget if he coached in Russia. Can you pay me? And can you play me? But, and that me attitude has no place with the team, which is why I think, which is one of the main reasons he's not there. Although I think money is the biggest reason.
Well, but when's money ever going to change at this point in time? Because he's always going to make more money in the KHL.
Yes.
I mean, you know.
You're exactly right. And the longer he stays out, the less money he ever makes here.
Right.
And I'm talking like, the contract on an ongoing basis.
You know, I don't know what exactly he's making in the K, but we know that if he came back to Winnipeg next year based on no leverage, given that he's an RFA with no arbitration,
he's not making
rights,
more than $1 million.
And that's probably an overpay. Well, maybe not. I mean,
it's an overpay, but probably based on leverage, probably more than they'd pay.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a guy, I mean, if it's strictly about money, it might be a long, long time until you ever see him. But, go ahead.
You know, going back to that 2010 draft, he was selected 10th overall. You want to hear some of the players that were taken after Alexander Burmistrov in that draft?
Sure.
He was taken 8th overall.
8th overall in 2010. There you go.
8th overall in 2010. You want to hear some of the players? Michael Granlund. He's a pretty good player. Jack Campbell, goaltender. Cam Fowler. He's a pretty good defenseman. Jaden Schwartz. Didn't have a bad year.
He's a good player.
Vladimir Tarasenko. Nick Bjugstad. Bo Bennett, Pittsburgh Penguins, was playing on the top line. Riley Sheahan. We saw him play for the Detroit Red Wings. There were a lot of good players taken after Alexander Burmistrov, who was taken 8th overall. As Richie mentioned, I think at this point in Winnipeg, we've hyped him up a little bit too much. And at this point, as Richie mentioned, if he wants to come back and he's willing to change his attitude, because I'm sorry, he left like a crybaby. He was benched by Claude Noel. And he wasn't playing well.
I disagree with your assessment that he left as a crybaby. This is a guy who looked at the, you know, do we say, you know, and I think it's a bias that we have, you know, you're a Russian guy, you know, you're 20 years old, you don't have a tremendous grasp of the English language.
Charlie Coyle and Emerson Edom also drafted late in that first round.
And somebody's offering you many millions of dollars more to go home and play in a more comfortable setting. I don't know that he's a crybaby so much as he is just a young kid who decided, you know, I don't really care about the Stanley Cup. I want to make as much money as possible while I can. I get to live in an environment I'm comfortable with.
Yeah, that's something you want to sniff out before you draft him 8th overall.
Obviously, the Thrashers made that mistake.
Well, and that's
a lot of the guys in place now were still drafting then. I mean, that's the interesting part.
Well, you're right. So you're right, because the scouting staff hasn't turned over.
Well, I mean, there's been turnover. I don't know exactly the details, but I know, like, Marcel Como's still in charge. Yeah.
Well, what I mean by that is, and we remember that year when he was scratched and he was complaining, and his play, he came back and he wasn't very good. He wanted to play. He wanted to play a more significant role with the Jets. He wasn't willing to play the bottom six role, and he said, "I don't want to be here anymore." And the way things left, I don't think was very favorable for him.
Yeah.
And that doesn't, and Drew, that doesn't mean if he wants to stay in the KHL. And he's Russian-born. He wants to live the rest of his life and play pro hockey in Russia. Then it doesn't really matter. But as far as him wanting, because the Jets own his rights.
Sure.
So if he wants to come back to the NHL, he's going to have to play by their rules, True North's rules, not his own rules.
But the problem is for the Jets is they've kind of lost an asset. They've kind of lost an asset here for nothing. And the longer it goes, the longer it goes, not only the less money he makes, but the less the Jets get for him. That's they were going to get a second-round pick for him 2 years ago at the deadline. That's probably a fourth round pick now. You wait another year, it might be a fifth round pick. And another year, you're just trading. You're going to trade trouble for trouble. Like, that's what you've got to. So, I mean, in that sense, maybe the Jets ought to have identified this as being an issue early on and made that move. But at the same time, it's very difficult to give up on a young player that quickly because he can come back to spurn you. And the Jets are pretty risk averse in terms. I mean, they haven't made any trades really in 3 years. So, yeah. I'm not shocked it didn't happen, but it would have been a little more of a difficult move. And you also have to take this into account. And I think people need to realize this with Evander Kane, too. What he does for another team, if and when that happens, does not mean he would have done that for the Jets. You have to understand that.
Sure.
So if Burmistrov had gone off, they traded him for a second-round pick, and had gone off to Buffalo, for example, and he had succeeded, it does not mean he would have succeeded here. Environmental, you know, there's environmental issues there. How you perform, who you're playing with, who your coach is. So these are all factors, but...
There's no guarantee Jonathan Toews, if he was drafted second overall by Pittsburgh instead of Jordan Staal, would be the same Jonathan Toews he is in Chicago.
That's fair, although he's a little bit different.
Of course he's a little bit different, but going back to Brumy for one last second, yeah. I do think that certainly there's a share of the blame that he has earned mm-hmm. over, you know, his time in Winnipeg, but hindsight being 2020, I think that Claude Noel also deserves a fair share of blame for
that. I don't agree with that at all.
Really?
I know. I mean, what do you want to do? Give the guy the farm when he comes in the first year? I mean, he just didn't play. He wasn't playing the team style. And I realize there's parts you have to understand that he's going to play a certain way, and he grew up that way, Drew, all that. And he, you know, he had the puck on his stick a lot, although usually for naught. I mean, he just did nothing with it. But I don't mind disciplining a young player. Maybe I understand your point in terms of mishandling it to a point where he wanted to leave.
I think it was too public.
Maybe it was too public, and they would have liked to do it a different way. But at the end of the day, he grew up playing in Russia, Drew. I assume he faced more tough love than Claude Noel gave him in Winnipeg. And that, if you read the stories about the guy, way these guys are coached, you know, at a young age, and I think Paul Maurice alludes to the way that, and if you read books on it,
yeah,
like Eric DeHatchick's book, King of Russia, about Dave King, how the players are treated differently at a younger age, and they're able to phase and to kind of tune out negative criticism. I don't think Claude Noel's handling of it was the biggest factor, and I don't think he ought to be blamed for holding a young player responsible for his actions, you know. And we're in a fishbowl here. If a guy like Burmistrov sits upstairs in Anaheim, nobody ever talks about it. I don't think he should shoulder the blame for that.
And Drew, I don't want to sound like I'm a Burmistrov hater, because I know in his short time here, his couple years here, he was a fan favorite. And I,
1 year here, right? Was it one?
Plus two.
Just two?
Two?
Yeah. The one... Two. It was one and a half, really,
yeah.
But...
Yeah.
For Burmistrov, it goes back to perception is reality, and the way things ended off, and how he was not happy that he was being benched by Claude Noel, and the way that he reacted to that and didn't want to be here anymore. But as far as the type of hockey player he is, he's obviously an eighth overall pick. He's got unbelievable talent, and he has that ability to even play that sandpaper game and get physical, and he has an offensive ability. We've seen that, and he was a good OHL player. But in the NHL, nothing's given to you. And when you go into that dressing room and you're saying, I want to do this and I want to do that against a guy that's, you know, been through the trenches for 12 years longer than you have, it just doesn't work like that. So if for me, that was my problem with Burmistrov. As far as the type of hockey player is, he's got tons of skill, and he had a good year in the KHL. But it all goes back to, if he doesn't want to be here, then why are we even talking about this?
And in terms of the Jets, you know, maybe if they have a do-over and have a guy like that again, maybe they bring in somebody like a Sergei Gonchar type to mentor a young player like he has mentored Valery Nikushkin in Dallas. And here, you know, Andropov, and I realize, you know, Kazakhstan and Russia, all that stuff, different areas.
We'll avoid the geopolitical aspects
of it. But the point is, if somebody who is, around, you know, older than you, who's come and done what you're doing right now and have a sense of calm. The Jets didn't really have that with him, and I think that was a factor as well. I mean, you pointed out to the kind of fish out of water, and he had that similar experience without the aid of somebody who had done it before. And Gonchar was there during Malkin as well. I mean, again, Burmistrov is not Nikushkin. Nikushkin is an amazing talent, and Malkin obviously has proven himself. But at the same time, when you provide these guys with, you insulate them,
give them some comforts of home.
Some comforts, language, all these things, that has to play a factor as well.
Let's head to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
The way we responded here, I think we're playing one of our best periods in the whole playoffs in the third period, when it mattered the most. I'm so proud about it. Oh, I mean, the guy's been unbelievable here.
New York Rangers goaltender Henrik Lundqvist, after they defeated the Montreal Canadiens to qualify for the Stanley Cup Finals. They begin on Wednesday here on TSN 1290. You can hear the entire Stanley Cup Finals on TSN 1290. I think it's safe to say that the Rangers are going to be an overwhelming underdog when these finals start. Doesn't matter who they play, either Chicago or Los Angeles. The popular opinion has been that the Western Conference Final is actually the Stanley Cup Final, and the winner of the Western Conference will be able to cakewalk to the Stanley Cup.
Well, it's hard to cakewalk, but yeah, Drew, I would agree. I mean, the best team's coming out of the West no matter what. I don't think there's a question about that. I mean, the Rangers are deep. They play four lines, and they're four effective lines, and they have six defensemen, as you mentioned. Obviously, they have Lundqvist. So they have a good team and a good goal and a good coach, but they don't have a great team. I mean, if they win, maybe they do, but I don't think they do. And when you look at who they're playing against, I mean, you want to look number one center. I mean, if you're going to consider Stepan or Richard your number one center, well, both of those guys are not in the same world as Andrei Kopitar or Jonathan Toews. You could argue that those guys aren't in the same class as Jeff Carter, even, depending on, you know, what you think about that. So you look at that. Okay, then you look at McDonough. McDonough is in the same class as Duncan Keith and Drew Doughty. I believe that. And Lundqvist is certainly in the same class as the other goaltenders, if not better. As Andrew Gross mentioned the first hour, talking about, you know, better than Crawford, although Crawford, I like Corey Crawford. But you look at the other star players, and they're just a step above, I think. Patrick Kane. I mean, I like Rick Nash, and I like Marty St. Louis. Really good players. Star players, probably. Not superstar players. Patrick Kane's a superstar player. You know, Patrick Sharp, Marian Hossa. Then you're talking about guys. Well, Hossa, I think, is a step above the other two guys anyways. But Patrick Sharp, you're talking more about the guys, you know, like the Rick Nashes and that type. So you're talking Rangers probably, the Hawks probably have the three best forwards in that series if they play each other. If you look at the Kings, you know, Kopitar, I mean, they just have so much depth and size. The Rangers aren't big enough or physical enough to handle the Kings, I don't think. That's why I agree with, as he said earlier in the show, I think they'd prefer to play the Blackhawks.
And I think regardless of who comes out of the Western Conference, guys, I've picked every single team against the New York Rangers, going back to the Philadelphia Flyers. So my, you know, it's almost like the opposite here applies to me as far as what's going to happen in this final. I'm not, I would still pick either the Kings or the Blackhawks to beat the Rangers. But as I was saying off air, I think this series will go long. And you look at the New York Rangers, who we know were playing so many games between the first and second round, and you see the five days, that they're going to have off between the conference finals and the Stanley Cup finals. They're going to be rested, and they won't have John Moore for the first game of the Stanley Cup finals. He'll have one more game left in suspension. But aside from that, they're pretty healthy. And
they are,
you know,
for sure.
You can match up the players of those two teams in the West versus the Rangers, Richie, and I don't think you're going to get many people arguing that the Rangers can compete. But when you look at the way that their defense has been playing as a collective and Lundqvist's ability to steal a game, I think that will mean that they can win a couple of games. And that their lack of top line primary scoring is probably why they won't be able to ultimately win the series or take it to seven games.
Well, one thing I think we need to note as well is, have they played at any level close to what the other teams have played at? Meaning, have they played at the level of LA or Chicago yet? I don't think they have. I mean, Montreal's not even close to... Montreal without Carey Price? A whole different series. Montreal without Carey Price, whole different ballgame. Never mind that you match up fairly well against them anyways. They're pretty similar teams.
And the reason why that is, Richie, it's not just that Carey Price is a better goaltender than the options Tokarski and Budaj. It's that the team will play better in front of him, it's so unfortunate because of how good he was with the two shutouts in the Olympics. He was having a dream season. And it's unfortunate Chris Kreider had to go and do that. That's another story.
I don't know how they didn't run Lundqvist, by the way. Not once. They didn't go in that crease once. That says something about the Habs, by the way. And that's not going to happen in either of these series. Andrew Shaw or L.A., Kyle Clifford, Stoll, whoever it is. He will have serious traffic in his face at all times. And that's something. Think about it. Who in Pittsburgh was going to the net? Once James Neal recklessly, maybe. Who's going to the net in reality if you go through Pittsburgh's lineup?
Nobody.
Who's going to the net? Now, they were going to the net in Philly.
Yeah.
And that caused some problems for them.
Sure. But Philly didn't do it all seven games, I thought. Philly just had an on-off switch.
Philly just couldn't skate with him.
Yeah.
That was the problem there.
If Ryan McDonagh, Dan Girardi, Anton Strahlman, Mark Stahl, the top two pairs we're talking of the Rangers, who have been excellent, talk to Andrew Gross in the first hour of the show about this. To me, they're playing at the highest level of any group of defensemen in the league right now, and that includes these two teams that we're seeing right now, the Kings and the Blackhawks. When you're talking about the Kings, you're talking about the team that allowed the fewest goals on average per game. So they're excellent. If those guys can shut down the Hawks, to me, that's the key to the series, because as we've seen, Kane was awful in the first few games of this series, and now he's turned it on, and he's got, 7 points in the last two games. So, to me, that's the key matchup there. And McDonagh and Girardi have done it. They've done it against Crosby, and they've done it against the Giroux line.
Struggled against Philly.
They did. Yeah. That's true. They did have some struggles. But they have been able to shut down top lines. They were able to shut down the Gallagher, Pacioretty line, Desharnais line.
But let's be honest here, Ezzy.
That's not the same league.
But Desharnais, Gallagher. Desharnais and Gallagher aren't first-line players. Pacioretty, I think, is a first-line player.
Yeah.
But Desharnais and Gallagher are not. Thomas Vanek. The ghost of Vanek, it certainly isn't in the playoffs.
Thomas Vanish.
Vanish, as they're calling him. But you look at the different guys that they're going to be playing now. Different ball game. And don't get me wrong, I mean, obviously, you know, you had Giroux needing to get off in the beginning of that Philly series, and maybe not, you know, they were effective. But, you know, McDonagh's been really good. It's had some spotty at times, but that's just going to happen when you play 20 or whatever games they've played, you know, 7-7-6, right? So you play 20 games, that's going to happen at times. But the star power that you're facing, I think the level, I know you're having time off. There's two factors here. The time off, which I don't think is, I mean, it might be a positive, but you've played one less game than these guys. I mean, then LA, you've played the same amount of games, right, as Chicago beat Mini in 5 or 6, I'm trying to remember.
Six.
So it'd be the exact same amount of games Chicago's played.
Right.
The time off plus the level of play in the Montreal series, I think hurts you more than it helps you, to be honest. That's what I think, because you're going to be a little bored. And then you're going to get ready to go. And you've been playing at a level against Montreal. Let's be honest. Montreal didn't give much of a test in a lot of those games. I mean, in game six, there's hardly any chances at all. I mean, there are other games. Game two, everybody talked about how Montreal controlled the play. Every shot was from outside the circles. I just think it's going to be a different ball game. People going into the middle and driving Lundqvist and controlling the play.
If you said Montreal was controlling the play in that game six, you weren't watching the same game that I was watching.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
no, they couldn't penetrate.
There's a couple of
they
games.
Couldn't penetrate the Rangers defense at all.
Everything was from the outside. I mean, you saw that.
But also, there was also a lack of willingness to go to the net, though.
Fair point. They did look like they were just emotionally spent at that point in time.
And Boston would have been a bad matchup for them. Boston and LA are similar. LA's got a better defense, though.
Mm-hmm. It all starts Wednesday. We'll find out if the Rangers can have another level to achieve. Otherwise, it might be a quick Stanley Cup final. Let's head to break. When we come back, we unveil our unrestricted free agent of the week. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca. Yeah!
Two hours down, 1 hour to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. I'm your host, Drew Mandel. The man on my left, Ezra Ginsberg. Richard Pollock on my far left. Producer Tim gets us on and off the air like the expert that he is. Richie, is this your rant of the week coming up?
Yeah. I find it very interesting, all these people coming out of the woodwork for the Bob Cole support now. Where's everybody been for the past 4, 5, 6 years when they've been ripping him every day? Twitter's a joke. Everybody, whatever's trendy, whatever's cool, everybody wants in on. I mean, come on. This guy is great. You've been ripping him for years for missing a little bit of names or whatever it may be, or missing a play or two, and now everybody wants to love Bob Cole. Everybody wants in on the bandwagon of Bob Cole love. It's hilarious. I mean, it's embarrassing out there. I can't even believe it. They're giving him credit. You know, I saw Ron McLean throwing to him and CBC giving him, you know, more attention because their coverage is winding down. Well, at least that they'll have creative control over it will be winding down. And I love that they are giving him due credit for so many jobs well done. We don't know what his broadcasting future holds. But the whole Twitter thing about it, it's just, that's too much for me. I can't handle it.
Yeah, and I got to say, we haven't had the opportunity, the honor, really, to have Bob Cole on the show, but we've talked about him many times. And to me, I think he's the voice of hockey. And I think that, you know, he's a little bit polarizing in the sense that because he's a little bit older, people say, oh, he misses names and stuff like that. I mean, he's 81 years old, but he's a legend. And I get goosebumps still listening to him call playoff games, especially when, as Richie mentioned, they were showing him calling the game. They actually had the video of him calling the game. But the focus should be on whether or not he comes back next year with the kind of the reincarnation of Hockey Night in Canada. You should just really, you know, do your homework and see how many games he's called, the important games he's called. And especially if you're a young kid and you want to go into sports broadcasting, or especially, you know, hockey broadcasting. I mean, he's a legend. You ask anybody. I mean, he is a legend. And yeah, sure. I mean, everyone has their personal opinions about what broadcasters they like. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that don't think I know anything, and they wish that someone else was on the air, right? But I mean, Bob Cole, to me, is a legend. He's a class act. He does a great job calling games. And if this is his last game, year, then, you know, I enjoyed, you know, the last few games that he called.
He's done a great job this series, but, you know, which is kind of bringing this up. But, you know, what he does is call the game. I'm going to push Mihalik back for a second. What he does is call a hockey game. If you talk to the color commentators who work with him, they don't talk during the play. He calls the play, and they talk during the whistle. One thing that I appreciate that he does is he captures the intensity of the moment. He doesn't get all excited for nothing. All these announcers go, oh my, for a guy crossing the blue line. I got a shot. It's like, man, he shot from the blue line. And you're not going to score from there. Bob Cole captures when the intensity of the game rises, the importance of the moment is there, and the teams are engaged. He doesn't get all excited for dumping the puck out of the zone on a penalty kill in the second minute of the first period of the first round. But when the teams are going back and forth like you're seeing in this series, that's when he gets in on it. And he doesn't yell at me. Doesn't tell me, oh, the net front and presence. No, he just calls the game. Let me find out some things for the game. Broadcasting has come to a point where all you're ever doing is yelling at the person sitting at home, telling them, oh my God, that matchup, that change, that matchup. You can get that into the game without being overboard about it or recycling the same old stories all the time. I mean, broadcasting, I think, has become, broadcasting a hockey game play-by-play has become, there's a different element to it, and I think that it's too overboard. I like the ability to sit back, watch a game, make my own decisions in terms of, and form my own opinions on what has happened, and not have somebody yelling at me all the time telling me exactly what happened. He's traditional. Yeah, I think more people would learn from him, but I think more people also, if TSN and other broadcasters would be able to hire guys like that or want to hire guys like that, I think in the future that would be a great thing. Like, you listen to Vin Scully talk. I mean, it is a storytelling. It's not yelling at you and throwing meaningless facts over and over and over again. That's why when you sit down and you watch him, when the game gets exciting, like these Kings and Blackhawks games, he gets more excited, and then you get more into the moment. as opposed to it always being a moment, because if it's always a moment, it's never a moment.
And at the end of the day, even though, you know, we're in the era of social media, it's still the same old game. And the game has evolved. I think Richie's right. That storytelling aspect of hockey broadcasting is what makes listening to him so great.
Well said by both of you. Let's head to our UFA of the week.
Across for Carlson, up the middle to Spencer. Right side to Hemsky, over the Ranger line. He's stick checked, but the puck stays in the Ranger zone. Chance for McCulloch. He shoots it, score!
The UFA of the week comes from the Ottawa Senators. Milan Mikhailuk is coming off of a six-year, $26 million contract. His salary cap hit for the past 6 years had been $4.33 million. A left winger, 29 years old. Let's start by talking about Milan Mikhailuk as a player. Richie, I'll turn to you to begin with. He's been with Ottawa for the last number of years, coming over in the Danny Heatley trade.
You know, he's a big guy, Drew. He's over 200 pounds. He's 6'2", and he goes to the net, and he goes to the dirty areas. Injuries have been a problem for him and worn him down a bit, and maybe some would say after his injuries he didn't go to the net maybe as hard as he did before. But he's a hard-driving, more of an up-and-down left winger, and a little bit more of a throwback, actually. But the biggest thing about him is, can he stay healthy? And this year he did. He didn't miss a game.
No, played 82 games this year.
But the year before, he missed a ton of games.
25.
And the years before that, you know, he didn't miss a significant portion of those seasons, but he did miss games. And I think as much as it's the injury, it's the injuries. It's the multiple injuries he's had to incur over the course of his career. Because if you look at it and mention his age, you're looking at a 29-year-old guy. But he kind of has that 35-year-old body.
He's got some mileage on him.
He's got some mileage on him. And that's because he plays a rough and tough style. Now, the question you might have is, does a guy who scored 39 points, 17 goals, and 82 games played, with playing with Jason Spezza, and has been playing with him for the most part over the past couple of years, and they moved the lines around, of course, but that's when the guy's kind of lined up beside. If that's his performance level, you know, what does the market bear for something like that? And I think he's an interesting one, because out of all the guys available, most of these guys are 30, you know, aside from the Vanek and, you know, the Camilleri guys, most of the other guys are 35 plus, slowing down. He's not even 30 yet. And
this should be is pretty close to his prime of his career, or still within sight of the prime of his career.
And you wonder, you know, I think there's much of teams who'd be interested and want a guy like this. The question is, can you lock it into him and be sure? Can you lock it into him long term?
17 goals, 22 assists last season, 39 points in 82 games, playing first line minutes for the Ottawa Senators next to Jason Spezza.
He's a 2025 goal scorer, Drew. That's what he is. He's a 2025 goal scorer.
He had 35 with Ottawa just 3 years ago.
Yeah.
His first year, or second year in Ottawa. No, probably, like, I guess, whoa. That was his third year in Ottawa. He had 35 goals and 25 assists.
He's a 20-25 goal scorer. And what will where will he go? I think he's better suited to a second-line left-wing role. I mean, he can play in your first line if you want him to, but I think he's better suited to a second-line left-wing role. And I think there are some places that make sense. To me, one place that actually makes sense in a first-line complementary role is in Anaheim, right beside Getzlaff and Perry. A guy, a hard-driving guy who goes to the net and play with a guy like Getzlaff, who's similar in style somewhat to Spezza, although tougher. And then Perry, and being able to create off the rush and create in the zone off the cycle. I think that'd be an interesting landing spot for him.
Yeah, and Milan Mikhailuk, been a big fan of his since the days that he broke in with the San Jose Sharks. You mentioned he came over in the Heatley trade, and he's been on the Sens for 5 years now. Richie mentioned, you know, 20-25 goal scorer, and those don't grow on trees in the NHL, especially when you know every year you're going to get that out of a player. And, you know, this segment, you know, we're talking about especially numbers and years and all that. And to me, for Milan Mikhailuk, you know, he's a good player, Richie. Is he a $6 million player at this point in his career? I don't think anybody's going to say in the salary cap world that, especially with his production, it's gone down. Drew, you mentioned he had 30 goals, 65 points for the Sens in 11-12, and including 10 power play goals. He's a player that's offense first and not a very good defensive player. He's minus 25 on the Sens. The Senators had an awful year as a whole. But I agree with Richie in the sense that Milan Mikhailuk, I don't think, is a first-line player, and I think that's why he struggled this year, especially Daniel Alfredsson leaving, Spezza taking over the captaincy. The big line was Spezza, Bobby Ryan, and Milan Mikhailuk. And I think that he struggles in that role. And I'm not saying that he couldn't play with Getzlaff and Perry. I think he has struggled with maybe being relied on too much for offense, because I don't think he's a guy that can score at the level. I think he's a secondary scorer, and that's why I think, Richie, you're saying plays with Getzlaff and Perry, then he can be a complementary piece. And I think maybe he wasn't as a complementary piece with Spezza and Ryan, because as we know, Ryan as well is a shooter. He's a guy that'll drive the net. But that line, it was good. It was a good line for the Sens. That wasn't the whole problem with the Sens. Their goaltending and the defense struggled big time when last year it was their strength. But I think McCullough is a guy that will get a contract. And what will it be, Rich? You know this stuff better than I do. Maybe it's $4 million. In between $4 and $5 million, but
yeah, I don't think it's. Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's. You know, I think you're looking at a contract of. He's not getting more than 3 years, I don't think, based on his injuries. And I think you're looking at 3.5 to 4. That's what I think would be a reasonable number off the top of my head. I looked at not necessarily right off the top of my head, but I think based on some of the other players and his injury history is probably 3.5 to 4 for 3 years. But you look around the league, as you had some teams, you know, Washington could use more of a player like that. Couldn't the Leafs use more of a player like that? Play more of a Randy Carlyle type style of play. What about the Habs?
Is he more
so? I mean, there's teams that need a little bit more of that up and down guy.
I mean, he seems like he's got the size to be in the West, but I mean, he could certainly, you know, still play in the East.
Yeah, he could play anywhere, and he's a guy that you wonder in the market if somebody's going to give him 4 years, because these guys a lot of these GMs just don't care about term. They'll say, okay, whatever, I'll give him another year. I think a 3 year deal is more of a fair just because of the injury history, and you have to make sure he's not, you know, fading a little bit more quickly than you might have thought. But I think, Drew, what you're looking for is a guy, you're looking for more of an up and down guy on a team that maybe has too many East West guys.
Right, and after Thomas Vanek, and after Matt Molson, and after Mike Camilleri, some of the more highly coveted free agents, he's in that second tier, right? So the teams that lose out, and he's a guy that I would expect to be signed early on in free agency because of his skill set. Even though he's not a very good defensive player, that's not something you're paying for a guy that you know what you're going to get. And it's nice to see that he's put together a healthy year after missing a lot of time with the Senators over the years. And, you know, teams, as we said, will probably have a bidding war situation for McCullough.
Does he match the 4.33 AAV that he's been getting, you think?
Now, I always hesitate to say for sure, because some of these guys get overpaid on deadline on free agent day. I would say no. He doesn't.
We only hold you to your predictions like when the Oilers make the playoffs.
I think he would be look good in Edmonton, because I think with a bunch of small players that you have, I mean, Taylor Hall's not small, but you have Eberle, and you have Nugent Hopkins, and you have Gagne, although they're trying to dish Gagne, Perron. You have guys who, Perron's bigger, but doesn't play really big. You have a lot of, now Yakupov, you have small players. A guy like that would change a little bit what you're doing. A little bit more, you know, a little bit more drive to the net. I there's a lot of teams he fits on. A lot of teams could use a guy like him. So I think there's going to be a market for him, and maybe that's why he will exceed that number.
Let's head to break. When we come back, we will look around the NHL with NHL news and notes. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
20 minutes past the top of the hour. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. This segment is brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the Linden Market Dental Center. Whether an elite athlete or a weekend warrior, an essential part of your protective equipment is a proper fitting, custom-made mouth guard. Give yourself peace of mind protection as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. Contact the Linden Market Dental Center, 204-487-2226, or online at lindenmarketdentalcenter.com.
NHL News and Notes.
NHL News and Notes for this week, where we look around the NHL and discuss whatever has been making news and notes.
Well, that was
really well done, wasn't it, there? You know, just don't get radioing
that
like
that.
That
was insightful.
Yeah, exactly. Experts like we are, as we said earlier in the show. Started in Columbus, where the Blue Jackets signed head coach Todd Richards to a 2-year contract extension.
Hey, but what can we add to our game so we're better and more prepared to deal with these teams in this tough Metropolitan Division next year?
Led the Blue Jackets to the playoffs this year, a hard-fought series against the Pittsburgh Penguins. They had the best record they've ever had as a franchise, 43-32-7 this season. Overall, Richards is 85-70-16 in 171 games as head coach. sort of the interesting case here in that a new general manager, Jarmo Kekäläinen, was brought in Columbus, and he had no experience with Todd Richards.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of similar to Gillis and Vigneault in Vancouver.
Right, Gillis and Vigneault. And oftentimes that's usually not a great situation for the head coach, but Richards certainly got his players to respond, and is the two-year contract extension, you know, it seems warranted to me. Could he be, are you surprised it's only 2 years, though?
No, I think that's fair, Drew. If you keep doing a good job, they just keep extending you.
Okay.
Don't go overboard with these five-year deals for coaches. I mean, these coaches seem to get fired every 5 minutes.
So. It means he's under contract for 3 years, really.
I know. Yeah, I know. Yeah. And, but, I mean, it's really 2 years in this day and age. That last year doesn't even count, really.
Right.
So the Jets gave Claude Noel a contract just so they could pay him to leave. Basically, it's, well, you know, that Ron Wilson, same thing with Brian Burke, and he got his extra year and got fired.
Yeah.
I like what Todd Richards has done. He's made his team difficult to play against. He's made his team big, tough, and they have an identity. And isn't that important to establish that identity? They're big. They'll go at you on the cycle. They have depth now on defense. They have Bobrovsky in net. They have a pipeline now with Jenners and different guys, young players. They had, you know, 3 first-round draft picks last year. That's one of the biggest things coaches can do. Develop a team identity. And you look at the Rangers, you know, I mean, you know, I think the Rangers are pretty talented. I don't think they're in the same class as we mentioned earlier in the show multiple times. As talented as the Kings or the Hawks. But they have an identity. What's that identity? They play a fast game. They move the puck quickly from their own zone. And they roll four lines and they come at you. Very similar, of course, to what Vancouver did. But what's Columbus's? What was Columbus's identity before Todd Richards got there?
Bad.
I mean, Hitchcock had an identity for that squad. But they tuned him out pretty quickly. For Richards, he seems to have the respect of the team. They're listening to him. And he's established an identity in Columbus that wasn't there before for a prolonged period of time. And I think people want to play there now.
Yeah, and, you know, this is a team that didn't have Nathan Horton for half of the year mm-hmm. and then didn't have him in the playoffs. And I think if he's healthy, they might beat the Penguins. And that's, you know...
Yes.
Mind-boggling to say that, Richie, because I picked the Penguins to win the Cup before the season started. But, you know, Drew, you mentioned that they gave the Columbus Blue Jackets a run for their money, and they really did, and then some. And, you know, Richie mentions Boone Jenner, and Ryan Johansson in his third year had his best year ever playing first-line center, and you had a good supporting cast. Brandon Dubinsky was excellent in shutting down Sidney Crosby, and Matt Calvert, former Brandon Wheat King. You had it, and Richie mentions the identity, and this team was difficult to play against. They're physical, in your face, but they can score too. And it's a young team, and when you talk about Ryan Murray, who didn't play during the lockout year, the year after he was drafted because of the injury, but Ryan Murray, we've talked to our friend Aaron Portsline about him quite a bit. Very good young defenseman. Richie mentioned some of the draft picks they had this past year, Kirby Reichel being one of them.
Mm-hmm.
The future, John Davidson, who we've had on the show, and Kekäläinen, Jarmo Kekäläinen, we've had on the show. Very interesting guest. Was on the HNL earlier this week, I believe. Yep. They have that franchise going in the right direction, and it's great to see because that franchise was not going anywhere. And that goes to what Richie's saying. That team was struggling to figure out where they were going, what kind of hockey they were going to play, and it's great for Blue Jackets fans because now they know that their team is going in the right direction. And that's what hockey fans want. They want to know the team is heading in the right direction. There's light at the end of the tunnel. So it's nice. Richards deserves that two-year contract. Absolutely. A big fan of his. And he did a great job this year. You could argue that he was a Coach of the Year candidate.
Lots of small players in the NHL have had successful postseasons. Patrick Kane, obviously, first comes to mind. Brendan Gallagher of the Montreal Canadiens, also a smaller player. Don Cherry addressed the future of small players on Coach's Corner earlier this week.
I'm going to tell you why there won't be guys in the National Hockey League like that. I would say in 5 to 10 years.
He's saying that because of the ban on body checking is going to affect the capabilities of smaller players to go through the junior hockey systems and the minor hockey systems to make it to the NHL. Do you agree with Don on this one?
Well, we should say, when you say, just for those who don't know, when you say ban on body checking, it doesn't mean that there's no more body checking the junior levels. It means that the age in which you start body checking has been raised nationwide by Hockey Canada. And it already existed in certain provinces. So we're talking, instead of now, when you're 12 years old, being able to body check, now that age is 13. So what he's saying by that is, now the little guys don't get to hit when they're a little bit younger. And that, when you're talking about...
To get hit.
To get hit, pardon me, at that elite level, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the when you're on that path to go into play junior hockey and all that, that year is important. If you're just, you know, starting to play hockey around 11 and 12 and you're still growing and all that, maybe it's not that important. It's only 1 year. It's not like they've raised the age from 12 to 16, right? But, I mean, sure, sometimes Grapes is, gets a little overzealous. But I think what he's trying to say is he's not in favor of this. And yeah. And I think when he's talking about the smaller players, that extra year that they could possibly get learning learning, I guess, taking a hit at that younger age, that's what he's trying to say. He thinks that might affect their long-term ability to be high elite players, right?
I mean,
that's what he's saying. And he might have a point, but I think they did raise the age, Richie, just by 1 year.
Well, I think a couple of things here. I think the first thing is that it was raised mainly due to concussions and to try to provide a more safe environment. I think television networks are kind of complicit in the concussion issue because they glorify the huge hits as opposed to the regular hit that takes the puck away. And that's kind of, that's an issue at a more of a macro level.
Right.
But in terms of what we're talking about here, I think there's two perspectives on the point that Don Cherry raises. The first is that a player, if he gets hit later, will not be able to adjust quickly enough because he hasn't learned at a young age how to evade hits of bigger, stronger, tougher players. And I think there's validity to that point. Conversely, if you look at it, you could say, well, the smaller player who isn't playing in body contact is able to develop his game, skill level, and confidence. And if there had been contact at a younger age, he might have left hockey because he was getting pushed around too much. And I think both points have a little bit of validity. You know, as you and I, we've coached before. You see young guys who are able to make it because they're tough and they can play around that body contact. And I've played. You know, we've played where there's guys who are great players, and then as soon as you introduce contact, and there's nowhere to be found. So there's probably validity to both of them. And I don't think I don't know how these decisions are. These decisions are based on safety, which I appreciate. But I don't know if they're based on a ton of they're based on compiling facts and information, but I'm not sure how much at the end of the day they've looked into the alternative reasons for this as opposed to strictly the safety reasons. And I understand that.
And there's still going to be body checking in youth hockey. I think, as Richie mentioned, these factors come into play here. The concussions. Are kids too young at 12? Well, when we were 12, we were already hitting, but now kids are going to have to wait till they're 13. I respect Grapes, and he's right about a lot of things. He's almost always right if you followed him over his broadcasting career. And to me, it would be more drastic if you raised the age to 4 years. Then you're talking about a guy's not learning how to hit until he's already kind of in that stage where he either is going to that next level playing junior hockey or whatever. But I think, he's got a concern, and it could be valid. But again, I think you're talking about 1 year here. Kids are still, kids out there, they're still going to get to hit when they're 13. So they're not going to have to wait till they're 18 or whatever to hit. So I don't know if we're still going to see the young guys. I don't think Nick Patan has anything to worry about. I think he can still, make the NHL. I think what he's really talking about is the next generation, the guys that are now, 8, 10 years old.
Let's head to break. When we come back, we head out to Los Angeles. We talk to Curtis Zupke of NHL.com about the LA Kings and the Chicago Blackhawks. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
Shortly past 11:30 in the morning, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. This segment is brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, the longest-running independent comedy club in North America. For over 25 years, Rumors has been bringing Winnipeg the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. Tonight at Rumors, it's the finals of the World Series of Comedy, the Winnipeg Satellite event. You can check that out at Rumors Comedy Club tonight, and just announced a concert series event former Saturday Night Live alumni Finesse Mitchell is coming to Winnipeg August 14th through August 16th. Tickets available, rumorscomedyclub.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We are pleased to welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show from NHL.com. He covers the Los Angeles Kings and the Anaheim Ducks when they're playing too. Curtis Zupke. Curtis, good morning, and thanks very much for waking up and joining us.
No problem. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Curtis, obviously, you know, game six last night, you know, game five in Chicago a couple nights ago was one for the ages, the overtime was, and then last night they just matched that intensity level and that skill level, especially in the final 30 minutes of that game. You know, is this just fitting that it's going seven games, given that the how closely matched these two teams are?
Yeah, I think it's probably deserving that we're going to go seven games here. I mean, the only question is how are they going to top these past two games, right? I was telling a friend last night, I mean, that was probably the best playoff game I've covered last night. It didn't start out great, but it kind of built to a crescendo. And, you know, the way these teams have gone at it, it really is like two heavyweights going at it here. So I think it's only fitting that it's going to go this far.
Curtis, we were talking about this earlier in the show, and does momentum carry over? And now the Chicago Blackhawks have won the last two games, but as we know, the LA Kings down 3-0, they were able to win all of the elimination games. Do you believe that momentum carries over from game to game? And what do you think the keys are for Game 7 back in Chicago tomorrow night?
Well, you know, Daryl Sutter keeps getting asked about the momentum question, and he always says that it does not carry over from game to game. I tend to think the same thing. I think momentum to me is more of an in-game thing, period to period, and maybe even shift to shift. You know, in this case, when you're so deep in a series, a lot of things go out the window when you're talking about momentum and home ice and everything like that. So this really is a unique series in that regard. As far as the keys for Sunday, you know, I think it's going to be about which team has the better defense. You know, these were some of the two best teams in the league for most of the season. And if you look at the Kings, if you look at the numbers, you know, they're allowing more than a goal per game than they did when they won the Cup 2 years ago. And they're still, you know, and they're still humming along here. So that's pretty remarkable. I think it's going to come down to who can put up the better defense. And, you know, quite frankly, the Kings have Jonathan Quick. I mean, and that's kind of going to be their trump card, I think.
Curtis, what matchup do you think Daryl Sutter wants to try and avoid when he doesn't have last change in Chicago tomorrow?
Well, you know, he's kind of been dancing around that a little bit. You know, he's tried the Kopitar line against, I think, most of the top two or three lines against Chicago. You know, he still hasn't really figured out a way to stop that Kane line, at least in the past two games. I don't know if he wants to put the Kopitar line out there against him again. It's one of those things where I don't know if there's any one matchup that he wants to avoid or get. I think it's one of those things where when you're going up against someone like Patrick Kane, you're not going to shut him down for five, six, seven games. That's just too much to ask.
You know, when you look at, but on that point, you wrote about it, Curtis, the line, the Shaw, Saad, and Kane line, and what they've been able to do, and you wrote about it after Game 5, and you look at it now, and the dynamic that Shaw brings to the table, how have you seen, like, how has he changed maybe even the dynamic of the series? I realize that the superstar players have obviously come to play, but lots of times, and you know, as you watch the playoffs, there's always these secondary players who take on bigger roles, it seems, in the postseason.
Yeah, I think Shaw, you know, I wasn't entirely familiar with Chicago when the series started, but when I'm watching these games, you know, every time I look up, it seems that Shaw is in front of the net, looking for a rebound, looking for a balance here and there. I think he's really given them trouble in that regard. I mean, the Kings usually do a pretty good job of protecting the center of the ice, and that's where Shaw has been most of the time here. And this is pretty impressive for a guy that, you know, plays on a team that has plenty of other stars on it. So this is, you know, when Quenneville put together that line, you know, you give him credit. That was a masterful move, because look what it's done the past two games here. The Kings have really not been able to fully counter it. So I think that's where I've noticed Shaw the most, is just the middle of the ice there.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290, online at tsn1290.ca. We're joined by Curtis Zupke of NHL.com discussing the Blackhawks-Kings series. Curtis, obviously games 2, 3, and 4 were the show of the 70s show. Jeff Carter, Tanner Pearson, Tyler Toffoli. Since game 4, though, they've sort of slowed down a little bit. Is that a function of just them, you know, the pace they were at was just too incredible to keep up, or something that the Blackhawks have done to adjust to them?
Well, I think last game they might have been a little more quiet than they have been. But if you look at that line, whenever the Kings have needed some energy, have needed something to get going, it's been that line that's got them going. So even when they're not scoring, that Carter line has really kind of been the ignition for the Kings when they need to try to get something going. So it's one of those things where, you know, even if they're not filling up the stat sheet, the Kings need that line to get going and to give them energy.
You know, Curtis, you've covered the Kings and the Ducks. For those who don't know, Curtis used to work for the OC Register, and you've know these teams really well. And you know, matchups and all this aside, how fun has it been to watch Drew Doughty in, you know, Game 5? He played 40 minutes, and the level that he's playing at right now.
Yeah, this has really been quite a playoff for him. I mean, this guy is just boundless when it comes to energy. You know, he played the 39 minutes in that one game, and the next day he said he wasn't even tired. I mean, he's one of these guys that... it's going to be really interesting, and to think that he's only in his early 20s, really. Mm-hmm. I thought he had his best season this year in terms of offense and defense, both ends of the ice. I was shocked that he wasn't a Norris finalist. I know it's probably because he doesn't put up the offense numbers, but I think he was right there in terms of those other guys. So, I mean, it's really been one of those things where you try to wrap your head around. There's really not been a player like him around, at least that I've seen locally here for a long
time. Might be losing you there a little bit, Curtis. I hopefully still have you. And you talk about Drew Doughty and offense from defense is probably the better way to put it. That's obviously been a factor in this series, and even getting later in the series, a lot of offense being created from the back end, and even during possession in the offensive zone. Is that going to be a significant factor in this Game 7 series, and do you see the coaches having to adjust for that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Kings have gotten a lot of offense from their D guys. You know, Alec Martinez has chipped in, Muzzin has chipped in, and that's something the Kings really didn't have in the past. You know, even during their Cup run, you know, they still kind of struggled offensively, and they weren't anywhere near like they were this year. That's kind of the thing that's been different about the Kings this year, is just all this offense getting, particularly from that back end, and with Keith and Cedric and all those guys. It's kind of been interesting to watch, just, you know, because I know the Kings better, and it's just been interesting to see how they've been able to generate more offense from that blue line.
Curtis Zupke covers the Los Angeles Kings for NHL.com. He's obviously been covering the Kings and the Blackhawks series. Curtis, before we let you go, how do you figure Game 7 is going to play out tomorrow night?
You're asking me to get out my crystal ball?
Yeah.
It's, you know, my gut tells me that it would be just extended this playoff every which way possible here. So it would only seem natural to me for them to go ahead and win this and go on to the final.
Curtis, thanks very much for joining us this morning on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Thank you. Thanks.
Take care, Curtis. Thanks very much. So, quite fortunate for Curtis there that we can't hold him to his prediction because the phone cut out just at the exact appropriate time there. But anyways, we appreciate Curtis joining
us. Right?
You think the Ducks?
He
took the Ducks, exactly.
Just a note here before we go to break. Apparently... as per the New York Post, Game 6 tickets for the Rangers, like Stanley Cup Final tickets, that's a lot, you know, because the Rangers are going to be playing on the road for Games 1 and 2.
Yep.
Regardless, Game 6 tickets on resale sites are going for an average of $3,262, which is more than the resale tickets were for the Super Bowl.
A Game 6 that may not even exist.
Exactly.
Well, isn't that interesting? I mean, it's going to be... I'll tell you what, the NHL has got to be loving it. It doesn't matter if it's New York, Chicago.
No, I think it does matter. Quickly, before we go to break, I think it does matter.
Really?
Because the ratings in LA are not even close to what they are in Chicago. LA seems still to be obsessed with this whole Donald Sterling thing. And Chicago's ratings are through the roof. I think Chicago's, what, a 7-something, and LA's like a 1.5 or 7? I mean, that's what the ratings are in the States. So I think they'd rather have Chicago, New York, and then the massive ratings in those two huge cities.
Well, I mean, in any event, you're either talking the number one the number one TV market and the number three TV market.
That's New York's one, Chicago's three, and LA's two.
That's right. So either way, it's a boon for the NHL. Let's head to break. When we come back, one final segment. It's called Rapid Fire. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. So, Ezzy's being his typical clever self on Twitter. Gary Lawless sends out a tweet that says, "We'll be curious to see, you know, the reactions," but he abbreviates reactions. Ezzy responds to Gary being a smartass and pretending to say, what does reactions mean? Or what does reacts mean?
I spelled it wrong.
Instead, Ezzy, you spelled reacts wrong, and it now says, you tweeted at Gary and said, what does read mean?
Why does anybody need Twitter? I don't get it.
Yeah, it's a good point.
Does that conversation need to happen?
No, that conversation didn't need to happen, but because Ezzy screwed up, I got to bring it up on air.
Twitter is... I'm on Twitter a lot less than I used to be.
That's a good thing.
I mean, it's not for everybody, let's say that.
It's not for me.
Not for everybody.
Rapid fire.
One final segment. It's rapid fire.
Rapid fire.
Rapid fire for this Saturday morning. The Winnipeg Jets announced that center Jim Slater successfully underwent hip labrum surgery, and they expect him to be healthy and ready for training camp. In the last 2 years, Slater has played 26 games and 27 games respectively. Can the Jets still count on Slater to be their fourth line center, given his recent injury history?
That's a good question, Drew.
Hey, there you go. I'm done. I'm taking the rest of the show off.
It's taken almost 3 hours, so you figured a broken clock's right twice a day. I don't know the answer to that. I'm really interested to see how he skates at camp, because he looked like it was a little bit of an issue skating-wise at the end of the season and hasn't really been himself. And sure, he succeeded 2 years ago with the likes of Tanner Glass and Chris Thorburn with him, and he was a very big factor in that as well. He's good on faceoffs. I think he certainly has the respect of his teammates. I'm interested to see. I know these injuries aren't anything that, you know, he's brought upon himself, and it's just been unfortunate, but he's going to need to be able to ensure that he can skate and keep up with that level to be able to fill that fourth line center role, you know, and it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, and he'll obviously be penciled in by Paul Maurice as the fourth line center, but he's just had a terrible run of injuries the last couple of years, and it's nice to know that he'll be back for training camp as projected. But I think absolutely he can. And, you know, Richie mentioned that the training camp and how he prepares for the season will be important, as it is every year. But I think once he gets back into the flow, and this year he only played, 10 games, 15 games? Didn't play that much this season.
26.
Oh, 26. Okay. Not a lot, though.
You didn't listen to the question, eh?
I don't listen to you a lot.
Were you on Twitter with Gary again, Ezzy?
Yeah, well, I don't know. Gary's getting upset now. He's backing down from the sandwich match.
Ladder match from earlier in the show.
Yeah. No, but I think Slates will be fine. He'll have the surgery, and he'll be back. He'll be good to go next year.
On Thursday, in conversation with Rich Scher of the New Jersey Star-Ledger newspaper, Devils head coach Peter DeBoer referred to Jaromir Jagr as the best puck possession player of all time. How much of a quibble, if any, do you have with DeBoer's assessment?
Well, not only is he one of the best puck possession players of all time, he's one of the best players of all time. I mean, Jaromir Jagr led the New Jersey Devils in points last year at the age of 42 and signed another $5 million contract.
Are we only talking about this because the words puck possession are in there?
No.
Like, whoa, Jaromir Jagr's a good player. Thanks, Peter DeBoer.
Well, I think what... I mean,
he made a point of saying that he thought he was a better puck possession player than Gretzky or Lemieux.
Well, hold on.
Great player, one of the best of all time. Not Gretzky or Lemieux, but he's good.
As far as Jaromir Jagr goes, and he still has this ability, he is impossible. And the only other player that I can remember maybe that's this hard to get off the puck is Peter Forsberg. But Jaromir Jagr, when he uses that reach, and he's big. I mean, you forget, he's always been big, 6'2", 225 pounds. Mm-hmm. He is almost impossible to get off the puck still, even at this age. Obviously, he's lost a step, but now he's changed his game, and he shoots from farther away and obviously can't doesn't get as many odd man rushes. But yeah, I think you could make, I wouldn't disagree with that. I mean, I don't, again, Richie's making the point that he's still not the greatest. I mean, you can have those subjective debates all day long, but I think what he's saying is, you know, he's basically commending him for the great season that he had. But, you know, it's an interesting water cooler debate to have, Drew.
Chicago goaltender Corey Crawford is being accused of battery after Los Angeles Kings fan Clark Wong claimed that Crawford sprayed him with water in the third period of Game 4. According to the police report filed by Wong,
so funny,
the bottle was filled with backwash along with water, and it has caused serious irritation to his eyes. If video exists of Crawford perpetrating this vicious, violent, heinous, despicable crime.
Is that your description or the police report description?
The likes of which the world has never before seen. What sort of restitution should Wong be entitled to receive?
He should get sprayed with Jonathan Quick's backwash.
There's no video evidence of this.
No.
So, I mean,
do people not have anything better to do
like
with their
what,
time?
This is backwash.
It's a difficult. I mean, does this guy not have anything better to do with his time?
Obviously not.
He leaves the arena after getting sprayed by water. Okay, I'm pretty sure the goalies, for the most part, drink the water like, over their mouths anyways.
Like they spray it as opposed
yeah,
to like sucking
it
on it.
Anyways, so he got sprayed with some water in his face, I'm assuming for mouthing off Corey Crawford when he was angry. And then he said, okay, you know what? That's it. I'm going to go down to the police station and report Corey Crawford spraying water at me. Like, do people not have anything better? Did he tweet about it too?
I don't know. I don't follow
him on
Twitter.
Well, this for sure never happened. That's the thing.
No, I bet you Crawford probably did spray him with water.
Did he Instagram it?
I don't know if he Instagrammed it.
I'm pretty sure someone else would have seen it if it actually happened. If it happened, someone else would have seen it. There's a bunch of people in the crowd. Nobody else saw it.
Does this water bottle have a Tinder?
In this day and age, though, with cameras, come on.
According to the Wall Street Journal, former Calgary Flames goaltender Mika Kiprusoff has the second most frequently misspelled name in professional sports.
He's not playing anymore.
Dwayne Wade of the Miami Heat leads all of professional sports in having his name misspelled.
Why is it? Because the Dwayne people put...
That was weird.
Well, it's D-W... It's D-W-Y-A-N-E.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's not D-W-A-Y.
Oh, I didn't even
it's
know
like
that.
It's like Dwyane Wade. What NHL player's name do you have the most difficulty in spelling and or okay. pronouncing correctly?
This is good. I thought, well, I'll let you go first, because for writing all the names, I've...
First one that comes to mind that always gives me trouble, Valtteri Filppula.
That's a bad one, yeah.
That's a tough one. Of current players...
Well, Valtteri Filppula is a current player.
Well, I'm trying to think of other current players. I mean, back in the day, Joe Nieuwendyk and Jamie Langenbrenner.
Joe Nieuwendyk is not bad, after you get the hang of it. N-I-E-U-W-E-N-D-Y-K?
Yeah.
That's like the spelling guy.
Yeah, it's like you're one of the spelling bee kids there.
Nieuwendyk was a tough one. I mean, there's a few tough ones.
What about Shane Morrison doesn't play? His name was like S-H-A-O-N-E. Remember that?
Yeah, that's right. That was a first name, though. That made it a little bit more difficult. But there are a few that make it a little more troubling.
I'm surprised Teppo's not in that list. Teppo Neumannin would
not
be
that hard.
Well, it was a little... There's a lot of double consonants and double vowels there.
There's a few of the Red Wings guys that always had some difficult names to spell. But yeah, Filppula was always a hard one. I always screwed that one up. I'll go with that. There's Langenbrenner wasn't that bad though, because you could just
it was just long. Yeah,
it was long. You could sound that one out.
What happened to Cheers and Jeers, Timmy?
Cheers! Congratulations.
He's brilliant.
He's a good guy.
And Jeers.
No, not good enough. He's a bad boy.
I never seen something like this.
Surprisingly not good.
Figured we'd be kicked off the air eventually in the middle of the show.
That's
didn't
fine.
Realize it was going to be from Timmy.
That's right.
Anyways, cheers and jeers, boys. Start it off.
I'm going to give a cheer this week to Randy Turner. Our friend Randy Turner won an award. Writes for the Winnipeg Free Press, of course. He won a 2013 National Newspaper Award in Charlottetown, PEI on Friday night, which is great. He wrote three different features. My favorite one of the three features was his Spring Fever feature about... kids playing hockey all year round. Randy's a great writer and a great guy, and I'm very happy for him, so give him a cheer.
Well said. Ezzy?
Yeah, you know what? I'll give my boy Randy Turner a cheer, too. I can't cheer anyone else better than Randy. We've had him on the show a bunch of times. Awesome writer, and good for him.
Absolutely, and I'll wrap up cheers and jeers this week by cheering Ed Snyder of the Philadelphia Flyers. He had been fighting cancer, but it came out earlier this week that he's been declared cancer-free. So we always want to see somebody fighting back against cancer.
Well, who's going to win a fight against Ed Snyder? That's what I want to know.
No cancer will take down Ed Snyder. So it's good to see that he's back healthy and obviously deeply involved and passionate about his Philadelphia Flyers.
Chalmerson's a tough one, too.
Nicholas Chalmerson?
Yeah. He's someone on Twitter... Well, my boy Damone said Lori Korpikoski.
Korpikoski. Yeah. It's not bad. Chalmerson might be the hardest one, though.
Quickly, who wins tomorrow night?
I think Chicago wins tomorrow night.
I've been so wrong so many times, so I might as well go with the opposite. I'll take the Kings.
There you go. We got one for the Blackhawks and one for the Kings. I'm going to go with the Blackhawks. That's it for this Saturday in the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Big thank you to our guest, Andrew Gross, covers the New York Rangers for the Record newspaper in New Jersey. Joe Beninati, the play-by-play voice of the Washington Capitals.
What about Shane Knighty?
And Curtis,
went to spell.
Curtis Zupke of NHL.com. Big thank you to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, and Bernstein's Deli. In case you missed any of the show, it will be available for download on iTunes. Search for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, subscribe, and get it sent to your iPod each and every week. Follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, Facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com.
How do you spell Dwayne Wade again?
D-W-Y-A-N-E. For Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, for producer Tim, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Stay tuned for Toronto Blue Jays baseball next on TSN 1290.
You've been listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
Catch the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live Saturdays on TSN 1290 and TSN 1290.ca.